MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's called the true epidemic of the 21st century. This is the dire, what do you call it, diabesity?
True epidemic is diabesity, which is a combination of diabetes and obesity. It's going to kill many more people over the next century than will COVID-19. Now, COVID, I'm not demeaning COVID-19 at all. It's killed around a million people around the planet. It's a very serious condition, very contagious, etc., etc. But we're talking about the fact that there are millions and millions of people who have type 2 diabetes. There are millions and millions of people who are obese and overweight. And that is the real epidemic of our modern world. And people have to understand, our bodies were designed to wander around a jungle for 30, 40 years with a spear looking for food. So if the food wasn't there, you went hungry. But these days, no, it's our God-given right to always fill our bellies. And so we have breakfast, lunch and dinner and sit in our bums all day and we wonder why we get overweight. So researchers around the world are looking for the holy grail to allow people to continue their dreadful lifestyles be able to treat obesity. And at the moment, we have an operation people can have on their stomachs, which is highly effective, but there's another thing that's also highly effective. It's called don't eat as much food and do more exercise. But probably what you didn't realise, and this is what I spoke about in the article, is that we have different types of fat. Now, everyone knows about the HDL and LDL being good and bad cholesterol. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about the difference between white fat and brown fat. Had you ever heard of them before?
I had, yeah. I had heard of it.
Well, what brown fat is the fat that little babies and infants have, which actually burns energy and reduces sugar and fat. But as we get older, we lose that brown fat. If you're lucky, you've got a little bit just under your collarbones, and that's about it. And the rest becomes white fat, which most people can see around their belly. And that, in fact, when you look at that fat, it's not white, it's yellow. But for the purpose of this argument, let's just stick to the brown fat, white fat story. And what they did was use this gene editing technology, these are people in the US, to boost the expression of a particular gene called UCP1. The name doesn't matter. But what UCP1 does is take human white fat cells in their primitive stage, before they've actually become established white fat cells, and the UCP1 then converts these white fat cells into brown fat cells. And they found that when they injected these into mice, they called them humble cells for a weird reason, they transplanted these into mice, and the mice markedly improved their insulin sensitivity, because most people are insulin resistant, which is the bad thing to be, and had a much better chance of clearing the glucose from the blood and less weight gain by being injected with these cells. So what they're suggesting is that what they may be able to do is, by some sort of gene technology, improve the expression of this UCP1 in human beings to be able to make more brown fat as opposed to white fat, which I thought was also interesting. And the second part of the article was a study that came out of the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, where they looked at a thing called GWAS, which is a study of genes in a whole lot of people, 450,000 people, and they did some RNA sequencing from a whole lot of different mouse cell populations, and they found that there were a whole lot of areas of the brain that seemed to contribute to obesity. Things like sight, smell, and taste. So when you see food, you smell the food, you taste the food, it processes sensory stimuli in your brain, and also other areas of the brain are overdeveloped for things like feeding and behavior related to learning and memory. But the problem with this argument, this particular argument about genes, is that everyone thinks that you are a victim of your genes. And a lot of people don't realize that less than 5% of our genes are fixed. The other 95% of our genes are in the activated or inactivated state. So if you overeat, you then would activate a set of genes that then codes into your brain to overexpress things in this area. So it's not actually the fact that you're born that way and that's why you do this stuff. People overeat because they're depressed, because they want comfort, because that's what they're primed to do. You remember when we were kids, your mother, I don't know if your mother used this argument with you, Brent, but my mum used to always say, "Eat your dinner, there are starving people in India." And you'd think, well, hang on, by me eating this dinner, is it going to make their food any better? But that's the point. You had this guilt put into you as a child that if you didn't finish your meal, then something was wrong. And so that can change what's going on in your brain. So obesity isn't just a simple matter of you were born that way. There are many factors involved.
One of the major problems we have in this country is the portion sizes. I mean, if you don't get a plate full of food in a restaurant, you feel like you've been ripped off.
Yep.
And when you come home, I mean, I've noticed it with what we cook at home. You seem to fill that plate. If you have I've often cooked some pasta and you'll put all the pasta on the plate and you'll think, gee, I don't really need that.
Yeah, but then you finish it anyhow.
That's, yeah.
Since the introduction of the all-you-can-eat salad bar, and there's never any salad there, but since the introduction of that, that's when the obesities really happen, when people are just... my wife and I went to America about 20 years ago, and we ordered a meal, which was just what we call an entree, between us, and we couldn't finish. We split it. We still couldn't finish it. The portion size was just ridiculous.
Quick question. Can you see a time when we'll be able to take a tablet and it will control our weight?
Look, I think yes. I think we're headed to that. Do I want that? No, because I think it just then promotes gluttony, and I don't think gluttony is good for you emotionally anyhow. And I think also, when you think about it at a more global level, we don't have endless resources on this planet, and the more we overconsume, we're just ruining the resources that we've got. We've got to have a more of a global view than just fill our own bellies and what keeps us happy.
A new drug that blocks the formation of killer clots to prevent strokes and heart attacks. And it says that the drug, which has been studied in human cells and animal models, literally blocks the minute changes in blood flow that precede a heart attack and acts on the platelets, preventing the platelet-triggered clot from forming before it can kill or cause damage.
Yep.
Can I ask you, is this working towards... Because I was interested to note they said there hasn't been a new drug to treat, let alone prevent, heart attack or stroke in more than 15 years. I suppose the medical world's been concentrating on other things. Is this drug heading down the road of something like a warfarin?
Oh, no, it's a different thing. Let me explain to you when we're talking about blood thinning. There are two different types of blood thinning. There's platelet-driven blood thinning, which is affecting the sticky cells in the blood, which is exactly what you're talking about with this. And that tends to be more on the arterial side. So the higher pressure side, such as the arteries, are more platelet-driven. So if you rupture a plaque in your coronary artery and a clot forms, that tends to be more platelets than clotting factors, although there are some clotting factors involved. Whereas if you have a clot in your leg, say you get on a plane from, say, Sydney to Heathrow, and you come up with a big swollen leg, and they call that the economy syndrome, you want to sue Qantas, but you actually should be suing your relatives for giving the lousy genes that thicken your blood. That's more driven by the clotting factors. So, and that's where drugs like warfarin and the newer drugs like Pradaxa, Eliquis, Xarelto work on the clotting system rather than on the platelets. So what we're talking about with this study out of Monash University is they've looked at the fact that just before your heart attack or stroke, when you rupture a plaque, what happens is that the platelets become stickier, so they aggregate together and form clots. And this new drug, they basically found in experimental animals that the gene that actually then makes the platelets aggregate more, they found a drug that blocks that. And in a study done on mice, they prevented the formation of a clot in the arteries once a plaque had ruptured by 100%. So they totally prevented any heart attack occurring in this situation. So this has only been done in mice. So is it a breakthrough? Yes. But is it a breakthrough in humans? Not at all. And firstly, with all of these things, what might seem like it's working well in the mice might not be working so well in a human. So we have to do, firstly, safety trials to make sure that the particular drug involved doesn't cause other problems. So to give you a sort of an out there example, in 2004 there was a terrific drug for arthritis called Vioxx. So every man and his dog was getting this Vioxx and relieving their arthritic pain, and then they found after a few years of using Vioxx that it doubled the rate of heart attacks. So you always have to test drugs for safety before you test them in large clinical trials for efficacy, which is a different issue. And so they found in mice that it is safe, that it works extremely well, prevents a heart attack by 100%. But anyone who's listening, this drug is not available yet. It hasn't been tested in humans, and it still could be 5, 10, 15 years away before it is available. But it's still very interesting research, because up to now, you mentioned warfarin, and we also should mention aspirin here. warfarin specifically affects the clotting factors, and it is a very, very good drug to reduce the blood's ability to clot. But as people know who've been on warfarin, it's a difficult drug to take. You've got to have blood tests all the time. You've got to be careful everything you eat, drink, and pills you take. The newer drugs such as Xarelto, Eliquis, and Pradaxa, you don't have to have blood tests. You don't have to worry about what you eat or drink. And you don't have to worry about the pills you take because there's no interaction. And they're a bit more effective than warfarin. So these new drugs have been an absolute breakthrough and boon for cardiology and other conditions. But if someone's listening who's, say, been on warfarin for 30 years because they've got a mechanical heart valve, there is no proof that these newer drugs work. You still have to take warfarin. So I don't want people to go, oh, I'll just go into this other drug because there's a better drug for it. So, again, the venous clotting or atrial fibrillation clotting is driven by clotting factors, whereas arterial clotting, you've got a stent, heart attack, bypass, that's driven by platelets.
Okay. So my dad was on warfarin. He would be able, and he hated being on warfarin for all of the points that you raised in reference to diet, what you can and can't eat. He would be able to, and someone in his situation would be able to possibly get off warfarin these days and take replace it with one of these other drugs.
No, mate, only if the reason he was on warfarin is because he had atrial fibrillation that was not caused by valvular heart disease.
Okay.
So we call it non-valvular atrial fibrillation, strangely. And if you've got that, then you use the newer drugs. If you've got a clot in your legs, you use the newer drugs. But if you've got a mechanical heart valve, you still need to be on warfarin.
New drug that relieves acute migraine, and it's in a clinical trial. Before we get into that particular trial, can I ask you a couple of questions about migraine?
Absolutely.
Which will lead us into our chat. My first question is, what is a migraine headache?
Yep. Well, typically a migraine headache tends to occur on one side of the head, tends to be associated with a bit of nausea, possibly vomiting, and also what we call a fortification spectra, which is where you get these flashy zigzag lines before the eyes. Now, that's different to a standard, I've got a bad headache, like a tension headache, where you just feel there's a tight band around your head, it's not on one side. It's different to a cluster headache, which is a sudden onset of a severe pain on one side that's typically associated with watering of the eyes or runny nose on one side. So there are a whole lot of different types of headache. But migraine is probably, apart from tension headache, the most common form and occurs, and this might shock you, in about 12% of the population. And that those people who do have bad migraines, they at least have one episode per month, 75% of people with migraine, one episode per month that causes quite severe impairment. So it's not just a bit of an excuse to go and lie down. We're talking about a severe problem that can severely disable people's lives. And some people could have multiple migraines over a month. So we really do need better treatments than we have at the moment.
Do we know why people get migraines?
No one is really sure. I've done a lot of work with a people called the Watson Clinics, and the Watson Clinics mobilise the upper cervical spine. So I think a lot of migraines are associated with neck problems, but also I think there is a strong genetic component, and often women more so than men tend to get it around the time of puberty. And it tends to occur more around the time of periods for women, of course. And so there is a genetic component. There's probably a hormonal component. There's no doubt that there's a stress component. But I also think that if someone is suffering intractable migraines, it's worth going to a physiotherapist who is expert in mobilizing the upper cervical spine. So it's not manipulation. I don't believe in people cracking your neck. But they can just do certain slow techniques to the upper bit of the neck and put the upper bit of the neck back into place, and it can markedly relieve migraine. But also there are a whole lot of other medications that work as well. The standard drugs, just say you had a bad migraine, with all the symptoms I've said, there's a group of drugs called triptans that you can take, and within a half an hour or so tend to relieve migraines in certain situations. But this new study, and I don't even know how to pronounce the drug properly because it's a brand new drug, it's called a Gepant or a GEPANT, and this drug is called Remigepant, and this works on a weird chemical called a calcitonin gene-related peptide, which is a small protein released during migraine. And they found that when they gave it to 1,000 men and women with migraines, within 2 hours of the onset of their pain, 20% of people had complete relief of migraine. But here's the interesting thing I find, Brent. 12% of people given placebo also had complete relief. So a sugar pill works pretty well.
Yeah, that's what I thought when I read
and
it too.
And around 40% of people who were given this Remegepant had relief from headache, nausea, and visual disturbances within 2 hours. So complete relief for 20% and certainly good treatment for about 40%. But mind you, the placebo group still had 25% relief. So that could just be a coincidence. It could be a psychological thing, or it could be the fact that the migraine's resolving anyhow and you're just taking the treatment so it gets better. But this is a moderate breakthrough for the people, for sufferers of migraine. And migraine is a significant problem that occurs very commonly.
Who suffers worse, men or women?
Women tend to get more migraine than men. And I think the reason for that is that women have more hormonal variations than men do. As you know, we have this hormone called testosterone that makes us mad most of the time. And women have fluctuations in their estrogen and progesterone, which then can affect the blood vessels. Because what actually happens in a migraine is you get vasodilatation or opening of the arteries in the outside of the skull, thus the headache, but vasoconstriction in the blood vessels going into the skull, thus the nausea, the vomiting, and all the visual disturbance. And look, as people get older with migraines, so if you have people in their 50s and 60s that get migraines, there is a strong association with stroke and with heart attack as well. So migraine is not a benign condition. Always needs to be managed and always needs to be evaluated.
Can migraine headaches start at any age? For example, you know, if you're 52 and you haven't had migraine headaches, you've had the occasional tension headache, can you get a migraine headache and that is the catalyst for a continuation?
You can, but what I would say to anyone who has new symptoms like a new headache, it's always important to have an MRI of the brain, not so much a CT. The MRI is more accurate, to make sure there's no underlying cause. It could be the start of a brain tumour, for example,
right,
or it could be the start of an AV malformation, which is a little abnormal blood vessel growth you have in your head, which could get worse as you get older. So there could be other causes. So I don't like people just to say, oh, this is just a migraine, I'm just starting to get migraines now, before you've had more serious causes excluded. And also there's even if the MRI is normal, especially for people over the age of 65, and who'd be that old? Certainly not me. people over the age of 65, there is a condition called temporal arteritis, which is an inflammatory autoimmune condition of the arteries that can also give you a unilateral or one-sided headache that can mimic a migraine. And that needs to be treated as well, because if that's not picked up and treated with steroids, you can actually go blind in the eye.
As a result of our discussion this afternoon on migraines, someone's just rung in and asked, if I would ask you this question.
Sure.
They get tension headaches and they can't take medication. They're allergic to medications. Is there a herbal medication they can take for tension headaches?
Look, there's, and I have no financial association with Blackmores. Blackmores do make a thing called migraine relief or headache relief, which can work for tension headaches and for migraine, that has in it, from memory, I'm not sure of all the complete contents, but ubiquinol, coenzyme Q10, it's got magnesium, it's got a thing called butterbur, and I think it's also got vitamin B2 in it, and that shows some good relief, natural relief for migraines or tension headaches. But I'd also suggest if someone is getting headaches, to have your neck looked at by an expert physiotherapist in the area who can do the mobilization of the upper cervical spine.